are listening to Teacher Toolkit, supporting teachers, parents and students worldwide.
Well, I think my main insight would be that reality of being in schools is so far removed from a lot of the commentary about them.
We help teachers thrive and survive with classroom ideas, cutting-edge school resources and research-informed teacher training materials. You will also hear discussions on the policy, guidance and research-based publications.
This week, listen to Ross McGill, founder of Teacher Toolkit, interview Fiona Miller, educational journalist, school governor and author of The Best for My Child. In today's podcast, some of the things we'll be discussing are the marketization of schools, the pressure on parents to choose the best schools, and journalism's role in education.
Hello everyone, you're listening to Teacher Talk at the most influential blog on education in the UK. Today I am joined by Fiona Miller. Hi Fiona, could you introduce yourself to our listeners and tell everybody what you do?
Well, my name's Fiona Miller and I'm a journalist and I write mainly about education. I've done lots of other different things before I started doing that, so I don't only consider myself to be an educationalist. I'm also a school governor, which is
I discovered you obviously through your writing, your work in The Guardian, obviously you work to a degree in politics, use that word broadly. Your great book, The Best for My Child, which was published a couple of years back. But before we talk about those things, could you just describe your own experiences with school for listeners?
Okay, so I was educated in the state system under the Inner London Education Authority, which is now, of course, disbanded. I went to a state primary school in Westminster, and then I was at the tail end of the whole 11 plus system. So I went to a girls' grammar school called Camden School for Girls.
Yes.
In Camden. And, people ask me about this. It was just a very, very different era. I think about it a lot now. Was it better or worse? It was less rigorous in a way, less accountable. But I think the enjoyment in education was probably higher, but it was also a very divisive system where children got separated at 11, depending on whether they passed what was a rather arbitrary test. So that's been one of my preoccupations.
Are you still in touch with some of your school friends who maybe went through the 11 plus and were successful, and those that weren't? Are you still in touch with a range of those people?
Well, I'm mostly in touch with people who came to my school, so they would have been the people who passed. But I do remember what it was like. I had lots of friends at the time who didn't pass, and that was a brutal, absolutely brutal divide. It's a terrible thing.
Word accountability, I'm curious to learn the school system then. Did it, it obviously did, but what are your views on, did it set you up for life in terms of life skills? Sorry.
I didn't work very hard at school. That probably because there was no accountability. I had a great time. I mean, I had absolutely fantastic social life, and I didn't get brilliant exam results, and I even had to go back and retake one of my A levels. And then I realised belatedly that I thought I probably ought to try and go to university. So I got into UCL, and that was when I started working and understand the joy. Okay. Of education. I don't think that would happen now. People are expected to do everything at a certain time.
Yeah, true. So for you, what happened, so you mentioned university, what happened at that phase of your life and where did it take you to?
Well, I started to enjoy working for a start. I did well at university, and then I went to join the Mirror Group's graduate training scheme, which was then in the West Country. I worked on a local paper for 2 years, and then I came back and started at the Daily Mirror and then went to the Daily Express. And so I worked in what was then Fleet Street for quite a long time. Then I had my children, became a freelance journalist. And then my partner, Alistair Campbell, went to work for Tony Blair. So I think people know the rest of that story. We both went to work for Tony and Cherie and then went to Downing Street until 2003 we left. And that's when I started writing about education.
My question was going to be, at what point did your interest in education start in terms of being a journalist?
Well, my interest in education I've always had it ever since experiencing the 11 plus firsthand. I always realised there was something slightly wrong with our system in that regard. But I think when I became a school governor in 1992, my interest really heightened. And I write about that in the book.
Because
That was the beginning of the era of parent choice and the league tables and Ofsted and so on. And then when we were thinking of leaving Downing Street, somebody wrote an article in The Guardian about why he'd taken his child out of a state school to send it to a private school. And it happened to be one of my local primary schools. So I was so angry that I phoned The Guardian and said, can I write a reply? I then replied, and on the back of that, I got offered to do the column in The Guardian. Then Channel 4 approached me about to do a film about parent choice. And then after that, that kind of became, you know, I hadn't really decided what I wanted to do when I left Number 10, but that then became my, you know,
sure.
USP. Yeah.
I'm sure this is a hard question to answer, but are there any standout things that you've written about that you think really shaped the nation?
The nation or the school system?
The school system in particular, yeah.
I think I've written about most of them. I mean, I think the whole market in education, people don't recognise, and I think particularly younger people or parents with children at school now don't recognise what a phenomenal change that was to essentially create a sort of quasi-market in schools.
Mm-hmm.
So much of what goes on now comes down to that idea and the sort of mechanisms that were put in place to make it work. So I'd say that's the first thing. I think the second thing probably is academisation. I mean, I was one of very early opponents of academies. Even, you know, when Jeremy Corbyn became leader of the Labour Party, I got accused of being a Blairite all the time. But I think some of the Blairites would have been quite surprised that I was seen as a Blairite, because they saw me as a bit of an irritating political friend, because I could see the flaws in the academy system very early on. So yeah, I've been writing about that for a long, long time. I mean, I think it's with us to stay now, so I'm not
going
to...
Yeah. No, absolutely.
So, but I think we can see why the difficulties that have arisen, especially with the massive acceleration that Michael Gove instigated.
Yeah. So 15, 20 years later, since the kind of first academisation things started to get into motion, obviously we know where we are today, but what are your two or three key things that you think are still wrong with that particular area of education in terms of the marketization of schools?
Well, I don't think anybody really thought through the concept of having thousands of schools run by central government. It just can't work. Therefore, you've got to have some local oversight of schools.
Mm-hmm.
Now, whether you like the local authorities or not, and I'm not necessarily saying it should be the local authorities, but I think there should be some local, preferably quite democratic, accountability for schools. And I think that's where it's gone wrong, because government can't control all these different sponsors, some of whom aren't, some are good, some aren't so good, and some are quite dodgy, to be perfectly honest. And some of them, and also you can't, you know, there's this business of the orphan schools, the schools that people don't want. I mean, that should be a national scandal.
Yeah.
And I think schools need to reflect their local communities. There needs to be more ownership locally of what the school system is like, because so communities are so very different.
Absolutely. And I'm really keen to pick up on this point about having your best school on your doorstep. And I know it's something that you've talked about in your book, The Best for My Child, which I'll come to in a moment. Is it political rhetoric, or is it something that is possible for every parent that they can have their best choice school on their doorstep? Or is it have we fallen for that one?
It depends what you mean by best, doesn't it? I mean, everybody's idea of best is different, but I think there are some things we could do. I mean, the word uniformity has become a dirty word in education, but there are some things we could do to create a more equitable mm-hmm. / uniform system, where you don't see these gross disparities between schools in terms of their intake and their results and all the things that parents are using to choose a school. So mm-hmm. ideally, if you had more schools with sort of balanced intakes, less opportunity to pick and choose, more reflective of their communities, and less opportunities for parents to bail out if they wanted to or could do, I think you would end up with a better school system overall. And actually, I think a lot of parents would be happier, because I think what we're doing now is creating a lot of anxiety for parents who feel they have to choose in a situation where everybody can't be satisfied. Mm-hmm. So people are always going to be losers.
No, exactly. I've done quite a bit of research for my new book on choices. The more choices, the more unsatisfied we are.
Well, I mean, all I could say to you is that we didn't ever look at any other schools. I know people think it's mad when I say that. We sent our children to the local schools. We didn't even go to the open evenings anywhere else.
Yes.
It's been fine. I mean, our children's primary school ended up as a bit of a basket case in the first instance. I've written about that in the book, but that's when I became a governor. And, it was very satisfying to turn it round. And what I can tell people is that if you've got two graduate parents and a rich home learning environment, you know, you go to a good enough school, your children, they almost certainly will be fine. All this anxiety is just unnecessary.
You mentioned, your own accountability as a child in school and your role as a parent and a governor. And I'm going to unpick this a little bit more. But in terms of the market of academisation and this competition between schools, is it a good thing or is it a bad thing? Have standards risen, or are we falling for the kind of political rhetoric?
Well, I do defend, all because of what happened at my children's primary school, I do defend the introduction of league tables in Ofsted, because there were some schools that were spectacularly bad, and our children's school was one of them. And that was, they were letting down a lot of kids, and they were letting down basically the poorest children. So I think introducing some accountability was a good thing. Mm-hmm. I don't think we ever quite anticipated quite how accountability would be the horse that drove the whole system. Yes. Everything else is now driven by the accountability system, to the extent that you're actually, you're losing teachers, you're losing good heads, you're creating a lot of stress and pressure in the system. And I'm not necessarily, and I think you're creating a lot of stress young people as well, actually. Mm-hmm. I think that we need to have a better balance. And I think, you know, the piece I've got in The Guardian today, talking to some heads about the current situation, it is very interesting. We have no Ofsted at the moment, no league tables.
Yeah.
Will the world fall apart?
Well,
let's see. And if it doesn't fall apart, then that creates an opportunity for us to think about, can we take our foot off the pedal a bit and create something that's a bit more holistic, you know, that's a bit more reflective about the other things that schools can do, and take some of this heat out of the current situation. Of course, we all want young people to be literate and numerate and able to move on to the next stage in their education. But so much is resting now on these exams and some of these weird sort of metrics that like progress.
Yeah, of course. And that, all that's been taken away from us, hasn't it, this year? So for context, the listeners, we're recording this in week 7 of lockdown. Fiona, tell me about your life as a governor, you know, when you took over this, your child's school, and how your thoughts have evolved throughout that particular responsibility.
Well, you know, what happened to me was I live in inner London, which is the most active school market in the world, probably. There are more state and private schools in the square mile where I live than almost anywhere else in Western Europe. I've watched the schools market operate very, very closely now for 30 years. Mm-hmm. My oldest kids are in their 30s. So it's been absolutely fascinating to see it work in practice. And now that I don't have children in the system, I feel a bit more chilled out about it. But, you know, I used to be very angry about what happened, the way people would, the things people said to me, you know, you can't send your children to that school, they'll have a Cockney accent, you know, they won't have children who've got the same manners as them, or you can't go to that school, the children are all black. I mean, that was actually a Labour politician who said that to us, you know, so, and it's horrible because it's not what society should be like. Children should all be valued equally at that stage in their lives.
And you've written about this in your book. For listeners, tell everyone, if you can, a 30-second lift pitch of what you've unpicked in The Best for My Child.
Well, that was the mantra. If everybody did the best for their child, the idea was the school system would improve and work perfectly for everybody, because this sort of invisible hand of the market, the Adam Smith idea, would effectively mean that everybody got the best schools they needed in their local community. We all know it hasn't worked like that, so I look at the evidence and look at what may need to change in the future.
Yeah, and I, what I loved about it is, you know, when I did my teacher training degree, I learned about the 1944 Education Act and the 88 Act. And it's a nice little historical lesson in there for every teacher. What did you learn about reading up on your education history?
I think what I learned most of all is we've never really got it right. We've never really got it right. Therefore, there's an opportunity there for somebody with a big vision that isn't the one we've had for the past 30 years to come in and say, okay, I don't want to throw all the cards up in the air again, because it's been very stressful for teachers in the last 10 years since the Gove reforms. But you know, there is a way we could move gradually to something that's more equitable, and where teachers are valued. You know, that's an incredible thing. And we have a massive teacher shortage in the offing, massive, with more children coming into the system and not enough teachers. And that in itself should be a number one priority for any politician to deal with.
Sure. I'm going to put you in a corner with a quick question. If I could put you in a corner, who would be your favourite Education Secretary of State today?
Probably of all of my lifetime. Well, yeah. I mean, I think of in recent history, probably David Blunkett. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I mean, I know a lot of people didn't like David, but I think he had the right instincts. He wanted a mixture of sort of rigor and accountability, but with a sort of a human side.
Sure.
And I think that actually a lot of teachers and heads would probably agree that those early years of the Blair government were a great time for schools.
Yeah, no, I look back on my career, and yes, I agree, accountability and standards and all that type of stuff. But I definitely think they were the happiest time in my career, the kind of early 2000s, in terms of budgets, people around me. Resources available. Now, I know your work's varied and complex, but in your work with schools, are there any kind of insights you can offer listeners, or at least your work with teachers online or through your journalism?
Well, I think my main insight would be that reality of being in schools is so far removed from a lot of the commentary about them. And I, where I see my role is, I don't know if I stop, when I stop being a governor, which will probably be quite soon, I'll probably stop writing about education because I don't feel it would be legitimate for me to do it, to be perfectly honest. Mm-hmm. I read so much rubbish about what goes on in state schools. Still,
how do you balance that role between your governance and any conflict of interest arising as a journalist?
Well, I never really write about my school. And also, I would never bring my own political views into any of my governance meetings. I'm absolutely careful about that. But I think that it can inform what I write about because I listen to the conversations. I'm a governor of two schools now. Mm-hmm. I listen to the conversations. I listen to what the teachers say. I listen to what the heads are saying. And I think we need to give them, you know, we so much talk about autonomy for heads and teachers. We need to give them some autonomy. They do know what they're doing now. Yes. And it would be a bit better if the system actually was led by them. In a way.
Yeah, no, I read the latest TALIS survey by OECD and England came dramatically at the bottom of the table, 45th out of 48 for teacher autonomy and curriculum choice, which is no surprise. Mm. Now, my passion's teacher workload, and I know it might not be your area of expertise, but at least your insights and the things that you hear through online or through your journalist work. What do you see as those biggest drivers for teachers, or at least the myths and realities which you've talked about?
Well, there's workload. I think there's stress. I mean, they are in a way the same thing, but I think the amount of stress that some head teachers and governing bodies put on heads and heads that then put on staff mm-hmm. is unconscionable, really. Mm-hmm. And I feel it gets transferred down to the students. And I think that does come back to the fact that we still have this sort of football manager system that, you know, syndrome, that if you get one bad offset or one bad set of exam results, that's mm-hmm. it, you're out the window and somebody else has to come in. Mm-hmm. So there's not enough focus on helping people to get better. It's very punitive, I think. And it's interesting, if you look at London Challenge, which everybody agrees was a very successful intervention, mm-hmm. that was all about, all the language there was about building success rather than condemning people for failure. And I think that's one of the key switches that we need in our system. So, all, you know, the schools were called keys for success, weren't they? It was all about finding from the best and helping other people to improve rather than telling them they're terrible. I think one of the things about the last 10 years since the coalition and Gove and everything is, you know, the way he viewed teachers, the way he talked about teachers in the public sector. And what's so funny now, sorry, I'll just say, of course, we are in this lockdown when schools are having to contribute to this huge public effort. Of course, they're now having to be incredibly nice about teachers, aren't they? Because they're keeping the whole system going.
Well, apart from Lord Adonis recently.
Let's hope that carries on.
Yeah. Now, in terms of your journalist hats, I was going to ask,
Can I say one more thing? I mean, I do understand why heads do what they do, because they're under enormous pressure too. That goes back to the accountability system. Yeah.
How do you balance between either what you're employed to write about versus the reality and the balance of opinions? Or is that just the love of being a journalist? You can write what you want to a degree and you held yourself to account. You have an editor that proofreads your work and things. How do you balance between the content that gets clicks, I suppose, or sells papers, to things that you're really passionate about? I just want to unpick your life as a journalist in some respects and how you navigate passion versus sales.
I suppose I've been a journalist for a really long time now, you know, back to an era before a lot of people can remember. And, you know, you had to start in a local newspaper then. You had to be indentured. You had to basically do an apprenticeship and pass an exam before you could then move into national newspapers. So a lot of experience, I think. You know, I don't write anything unless I've really read about it and researched it and understand and know what I'm saying. And then I think my views are totally legitimate, defensible.
And your thoughts on the kind of blogging world now, where I suppose everyone could be a journalist? I say that word loosely.
Well, I mean, I think it's brilliant in a way, because I think I do fear that we are going to see off the end of print newspapers, because everything's going to... and in a way, that's no bad thing, because I think some of the right-wing media in this country have been responsible for some terrible, terrible things. And we can see it happening now. I mean, Alice and I were talking this morning about the lack of scrutiny of Johnson, in a way, compared to, say, what would have happened, or even Cameron, compared to the scrutiny that the Blairs were under. And, of course, we were there at the front line dealing with it on a daily basis. Mm-hmm. And that's because there's an inbuilt bias towards Conservative government. So if some of those papers folded, I don't think... I'd be at all sorry. And I think the rise of citizen journalism and blogging and so on
is
one of the things that's going to undermine the old sort of monopolies.
Yeah, well, you can especially see it through lockdown, where a lot of journalists have been calling for the print newspapers to survive and things. My work in social media, I'm keen to understand your own knowledge of fake news, and perhaps not just your understanding, but how can you pass on any wisdom to teachers who are listening to this in terms of how they work out what's right wing, left wing, made up, fabrication, you know, the whole spectrum of
news. I think one thing I've noticed, it's been really interesting this period, being at home all the time and reading the papers. It's so obvious to me when something is being put out into the media to just distract the scent from what's really going on.
Yes.
And you've always got to think, okay, who's what's the motivation here for this story? You know, I've read 15 times now that there's going to be this test to test antibodies ready in 2 weeks. Well, 2 weeks passes, it never comes. But, you know, it's just central government, number 10, just put out these stories to stop people writing about the things they don't want them to write about. So you've really got to understand there's a lot of other influences at force here. It's not just people presenting information to you. They're being fed information which is designed to sway public opinion and distract dissent.
And before social media, how did the kind of that fake news manifest itself in print form?
There was plenty of fake news. It was just in the papers. I mean, I used to work for the Daily Express in the 1980s when Margaret Thatcher was Prime Minister. Mm-hmm. And I can remember seeing Norman Tebbit, who was the chairman of the Conservative Party, in the office one night, presumably giving the editor his instructions. But, you know, there was a form of fake news. Then everything was slightly opinionized. Even the news coverage would be laden with comment. I think some of the fake news now is so absurd that I think anybody with a vaguely discerning eye would recognise that. Mm. And that is bad. But, it, you know, it's always been around. It's always been around. People have been manipulated for generations.
I'm keen to just unpick your thoughts on the future of education. You know, and although we've got COVID-19 going on, and that's going to be a big distraction for everyone in all sorts of industries, once the dust settles, what were, before the virus, I suppose, your hopes for the future of education?
Well, my hopes would be that the Labour Party, of which I'm no longer a member, incidentally, would finally get a big vision for education with an education secretary who could articulate it and win an election and put it into action. Mm-hmm. And it would be one that addresses where we are now and the things that need to change, but do it in a way that, you know, can carry the public with them. Because I think there is a basic understanding that some things are just not working at the moment and they need to be put right.
Great, thank you. Now, I've passed the 20-minute mark on my podcast, and that's where I fire loads of quick-fire questions at you. So no pauses and hesitations, please, Fiona. Mm. So here we go. What's your project you're working on at the moment? What's on your desk?
Well, apart from the Guardian column, I'm looking into the history of my old school, Camden School for Girls, which has got quite an interesting archive. So it's quite an interesting... It tells the story of London education and national education as well.
Okay. What books are you reading for fun?
I'm reading a book about the Second World War and Churchill at the moment. I'm not sure it's much fun. And before that, I listened to an audio book about Hitler. So that's not exactly... Okay. I don't know what that tells you about the state of my mind.
Okay. Beyond the Guardian, what's your source of news?
Probably Twitter.
Okay. If you weren't a journalist, what would be your dream job?
Sometimes I wished I'd gone into something that was more of a kind of stable profession, like becoming a lawyer or even a teacher. Yeah, but then anyway, I didn't do that because at that stage of my life, I wasn't thinking like that. So,
okay. Biggest journalist achievement?
I think influencing the arguments about education at certain points. Yeah, I think there have been points in the sort of the history of policy making where I've been able to have some influence on what people think and what people understand.
Who's the most famous person you've interviewed?
Probably Margaret Thatcher. Yeah, I was the only person to interview her after she resigned. Yeah, right. And it was a spectacular sort of semi-failure because my tape recorder broke and she could see it wasn't turning, but she didn't tell me. But right, it was quite, I was so terrified. I didn't want to say anything about
and where, it. Where was that interview conducted?
It was conducted in the little office that she'd moved into in Westminster, just off Smith right. Square. After
she I live around the corner from her old office here in Finchley.
Oh, really?
Top tips for being a governor? Not a chair, just a governor.
Know when to intervene and when not to intervene.
Okay. How secrets for balancing two chair and governor roles? What's your secret?
Keep your eye on the bigger picture. Don't get down in the weeds too much. You know, there's a lot of governors get stuck in the sort of detail that's really the management of the school and not their responsibility.
Okay, sure. Who do you recommend I interview next and why?
What I'm really interested in now is the voices of young people. I would like to hear from some of these young people at the moment who aren't in school what their experience is like. I'd like to hear about them when they get back to school. I don't think we think enough about the whole education system from the point of view of the young people. I think hearing their voices would be incredibly valuable for us all.
I might chase that one. That's a great idea. 30-second lift pitch for your book. I know you asked for this earlier, but when people have read cover to cover, what do you hope they'll take from it?
A better understanding of why we are where we are. A better understanding for younger parents and younger, you know, students of education.
Mm-hmm.
Understand the roots of it all.
Sure. And where can listeners find out more about you? Websites, articles?
Probably Wikipedia, and go to Alistair's Wikipedia, my Wikipedia, or
okay.
There's plenty online about our various different careers, but also The Guardian. If you want to hear what I think about things, go troll through all my Guardian articles.
Okay. Last question. What do you want? What would you like to be your legacy?
Making a difference?
Okay, great.
My professional legacy?
Just generally.
Personal, yeah. You know, I'd like my children to be happy. And
well, what's going
to
go in your epitaph, I suppose?
I think making a difference, you know, that is it's important, yeah. Okay. Even if it's making a difference to my local schools, you know, that means a lot to me.
I'm confident you have. So, Fiona, just thank you for your time. Thank you for inspiring me. For your amazing work in journalism and for education, the wider education sector. It's been a real pleasure to chat with you, particularly this challenging time that we're all facing here in lockdown. And keep up the good work.
Well, thank you for everything you do for teachers.
My pleasure.
Okay. Bye, Ross.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To continue the conversation, head over to www.teachertoolkit.co.uk and our social media channels to access all the links and resources mentioned on today's show. Why not share this with your colleagues and give them the gift of time, reduced workload, and increased impact? Until the next time, before you look after your students, look after yourself.